teenage. We lived on a windy hilltop in the new town of Hatfield, Hertfordshire, in the south of England, 20 miles north of London. It was one of the many estates which were part of the rehousing schemes of post-war Britain. 2 stories, wimpy built, little boxes, in lines on a hillside, all looking just the same, and just as Pete Seeger would sing. And yet, our family would thrill to the luxury of living in a new home with all the mod cons. The year was 1956, and we had never had it so good. After the grey streets of Glasgow, I was astounded at the colours and sights of my new land, the different varieties of green. Hatfield lay in the lush forested countryside, chirping with birds and bursting with blossom, by ponds filled with fishes, tadpoles and newts. Sometimes the deep roar of the jet engines could be heard coming up from the plain below. There the factory lay, where my father worked, for the company that made the first jet passenger plane. But the new school was a problem for me. I still spoke in a heavy Glaswegian tongue. The other boys made much of this, until eventually I transformed my speech into a good Hertfordshire edgeock. Mum worked in Nabisco, and I was a latchkey kid for a while, watching TV until she came home. Then at the age of 11, I went to a secondary modern co-ed girls and boys. St. Audrey's had lots of glass and concrete, with a library, gymnasium and large playing fields. We boys had a uniform of the usual grey trousers, a navy blazer with a tie. The school shield was sewn to the hanky pocket. In the physical training periods a couple of years later, I was surprised to hear the records of the Shadows being played as I jumped the horse, staggered with the medicine ball, or turned cartwheels. After PT, in the showers, the fat boy would scream as the wet towels were applied to his clammy, exposed skin. In time I rose to the position of house captain. The main privilege of this was that it allowed me and my friends to stay indoors in the common room at break periods, jiving to records or playing lap chess with the girls, while outdoors the sharp winds froze faces red in the playground. The records in the charts at the time were North to Alaska, One Way Ticket to the Blues, and Candyman. I started to buy Buddy Holly records with the money I earned working in the market on Saturdays, selling cakes with my dad. I worked a bit on Saturday, pushing cake on a stall, went and bought some Buddy Holly, and soon I had them all. I couldn't afford albums, so I bought Buddy Holly EPs. I collected Buddy in groups of 4 songs and played them on a dansette turntable in mono. I learned to be simple from him and to breathe the words. The tracks, Listen to Me, Rave On, with their clear, clean production, are as fresh now as they were when they first rolled onto tape way back then. By now, I was having a better time of it with authority. But one windy day, I passed Tanya in the central courtyard of the school, in view of the headmaster's distant glass office. Tanya was a rival house captainess, with classical features and long dark hair. We were not that near to each other, but from where he watched, the head saw her cotton skirt lift in the wind and called me to his room to tell me off for touching her up and to give me a caning. I was innocent this time, though guilty many times when he had not been looking. Tanya was gorgeous, but I was more attracted to her best friend Jilly. So there I was in class, tipping my seat back to feel Jilly under the desk. The teacher, hearing sniggers, yelled, "Leech, come here immediately." Not an easy thing to do, crouching and trying to hide my tenting school trousers. "And just what do you think you are playing at, Leech?" More laughter. "Is this the way you must behave in my class?" By now the class was roaring. I return to my place, where I craftily put my hand to my mouth. The beautiful smell of mermaid juice was still on my fingertips. The influence of my father's talent for recitation was beginning to show. I would stand at assembly behind the holy book and recite to the multitude below. No idea what the text meant, but I raised my voice, then lowered it meaningfully. The Church of England was becoming less and less well attended in those days. Later it would try to increase its flock by introducing pop music into the services. Later still, the reggae songs of Bob Marley would bring many back to God with the Rastafarian sacrament, the smoking of the holy herb, marijuana. Christianity's priests had converted the African people while they were enslaved on the Caribbean sugar plantation, but later Bob Marley would influence millions of white people with his pure form of Gnostic Christianity. On the playing fields, I was not excused from games because of my polio. This was, no doubt, good for me, but I was not fast enough on the football field. In the gym, I could turn on a penny, though, and my hands were large and talented, so when the PT teacher brought basketball into the school, I was in there. Soon I had my own team, wearing American strip and KED shoes. My father continued to train me at swimming. I would become a champ at county level. But better than the accolades, I recalled the blonde in our relay team. Most nights after school were spent standing in the lane with this girl. "What were you doing all this time?" demanded my mother. "Dinner cold and homework not done." But the truth was that I was not doing as much as I would have liked. This girl was so beautiful, so perfect, that I was a little frightened of her. She was like a goddess, and the words died on my lips. I had three pals at school. Mick Sharman, Ron Dippy Gale, and David Richards. Dippy had what is nowadays called a nerdish look. Round spectacles and a clean shirt and a smart tie. But the impression of nerdishness was misleading. His smiling moon face was crowned with a swatch of short black hair dangerously dashed over one eye, and he was a wicked mimic. Mick had posh parents and was brought up on health food, so he would love to visit my house to eat sugar and white bread. He was a handsome devil, his dark hair and rugged features soon ensuring that he would do all right in any Mecca ballroom. He was the first in our foursome to become a mod. David was a Welsh boy, thin, sensitive, with a self-deprecating form of humour. His angular face reminded me of Tom Courtney in the film Billy Liar. David was a Celtic immigrant like me and a painter. We four found in each other a gentle gang, determined to explore girls, clubs, and dancing. Up in the local youth club, Downs Farm, boys and girls would jive to records while the table tennis balls ticked and the billiard balls clicked in the back room. I remember Dippy, Mick and I mimed to a single that was out then, The Monster Mash. I was dressed as Dracula with my two friends in drag as the Vampirettes. Then we three formed a band, and I played drums. My mother sewed us hoods of black satin, holes cut for the eyes, and the hood motif was painted on the drum. The short-lived macabres were born. Drums, a guitar, and a saxophone, and three songs in our repertoire, Summertime from Porgy and Bess, Long Gone Lonesome Blues by Hank Williams, and another I forgot. Mick played the guitar and Dippy the sax. I played drums. Soon I would switch to guitar. With a friend, I sang Hank Williams. Wire brushing a snare. Became a mod, fast and looking snappy. I bought a Grundy reel-to-reel tape recorder, and at night I would record secret radio shows in my bedroom in the dark. I made effects and spoke the narration to mysterious tales of lonely city streets and solitary areas. I loved radio serials. And so I began to chat up the mod girls and preen and show off the gear I was buying. I had a jacket made in brown cord, no collars. Wow! On Mick's scooter, we followed packs of mods on the way to Mecca ballrooms to dance with the girls. We danced well to bands like Brian Poole and the Tremolos, Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, Freddie and the Dreamers, and the High Numbers. The High Numbers, soon to be called The Who, thrilled the mods with a mixture of Motown, Beach Boys, and irreverent antics. One night, Roger Daltrey leapt from the stage and landed on me with a bottle of cola mixed, I could smell it, with whiskey in his hand. Daltrey was laughing as he picked himself up. "Sorry, mate, you all right?" Solid and compact, Daltrey was a likely lad with attitude and already a youth hero. I smiled at him. "Of course I am." That was fantastic. Soon I would be there with my peers, stage diving into revolution. My mates would be the small fraternity of music stars rising from the squalid tenements and new towns of post-war Britain. Purple Hearts and alcohol were the stimulants that helped pillheads to dance all night and into the dawn chewing gum. Rival gangs in stiff collars and braces prowled the meccas, their mod girlfriends in page boy haircuts. Now I, too, was actually going out dancing with fully dressed, made-up mod girls who knew how to smoke cigarettes. When did I lose my virginity? I wonder. I do remember the wonder of smooth, silken thighs and her slightly drunken body on the absent parent's double bed, piled high with coats. And afterwards, the girl stood and cried, softly, then harshly. We were schoolchildren. We'd lost our virginity together. I can't recall her name, but she appears in the song later. Rambling Boy. I was reaching the end of secondary school, and the end of my mod phase too, because soon I would be introduced to the Beat Girls and all their jazzy, dark, and decadent joys.